welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. He played Neil Perry in Dead Poets Society, Dr. James Wilson in House, and the Reverend Forte in Gilded Age. My guest is the Tony Award-winning actor, Robert Sean Leonard. He's been plying his trade for over 40 years, and he's still a young guy. And he's comfortable on movies and television and theater. But Bobby, let's go back. Let's go back to, well, how about the new players in Richwood and your mom?
Well, that's about as far as you can get, pretty much. There's a company called the New Players Company. They don't exist anymore, but when I was a child, in a town called Ridgewood, New Jersey, which I'm sitting in right now, I grew up here. It was a for-profit theater company, sort of a summer camp for 15 to 22-year-olds or so, and people would pay. Our high school here in Ridgewood has a pretty rare, has an actual theater. It's not an auditorium. It's an actual theater with proper seating and catwalks, and it's beautiful. So this, I don't know who they were, but they rented the space for the summer. So they would run this theater camp in our high school, in our town's high school. And they did 10 shows in 10 weeks, musicals. And we were always striking or building a set, it seems to me, in my memory. And my mother, there were sandwich board signs that they'd put outside the school to advertise the plays. And my mother painted them. She was artistic, and she would paint. It was Music Man, or she'd paint. She would sketch out the big poster board sign. And I would paint in the colors for the each week's advertising boards for the play that was being done. So I was 9 years old, and I was always in the basement with my mom painting signs. And this theater company was going on over my head all summer long. And of course, I got to know all the people, and all the kids thought I was adorable. And I became the kid. And I started hanging around the crew. I started helping build the sets. I would take runs to the lumberyard with the crew guys. I would put gels in the lights. I really had a great, great time, a great experience. And then, for better or worse, they began to put me on stage, because whenever they needed a kid, there was no one in the theater group that young. So if there was a child in the play, they asked my mom if they could use me. So they would put me on stage to play things, not big, like it was Oliver, probably not, but, you know, Winthrop and Music Man or something. So I started doing these roles in this strange company. And one day, my father had gone to college, Montclair State, with a man named Marty Winkler, who was kind of in the know. He knew some agents in New York. He had a friend named Jackie Zeman, who was a soap star. And he saw we ended up doing Oliver, and I played the Artful Dodger. And I was embarrassed, because I was always embarrassed to be on stage. I liked the crew very much. The actors were never my favorite people. And I always felt a little bit silly on stage. And so Marty came to see this production of Oliver, and he told my father that he thought I was exceptional in some way. And months after that, there was an audition in New York for something, and he asked my dad if he could bring me in for the audition. And I don't remember why I said yes, but I did. And I got the part. It was to play understudy a play by Albert Inarritu, who wrote Gemini. He had a play at the Public Theater called Coming of Age in Soho. And there were three young men in it, and they needed a standby for the three young parts. And I was old. My age was right between all the three ages of the parts of the characters. So suddenly I was 14 years old, and I was sitting in a room with Joseph Papp, and Albert Inarritu, Mandy Patinkin, and Sam Waterston, and Kathleen Widows, and Blythe Danner, and all these people were walking around me at the Public. And I was suddenly an actor.
Well, let me ask, did you have to understudy all three roles?
Yes.
Whoa, so you had to do basically the play?
Well, from the younger perspective, yes, I had to be ready to go on for all three of the parts. And I was there every night. Jason Robards came one night. I can't imagine why. I think he must have known Albert, the playwright, but he saw me and I had a clipboard because I was a little bit pretentious. And he said, and I was sitting in the back and he said, "What's up with you?" or something. And I said, "I'm the understudy." I thought I was so proud. And he said, "Ah, the shit job." And that was my introduction to Jason Robards. And the last time I spoke to him, I think.
Well, let me ask you, I understand, you'll tell me if this is true, that you ended up dropping out of high school? Is that true?
Oh, yes. Well, so I guess we'll go more quickly now, but I was 14, so I was working at the Public as an understudy. I then got an audition to do a play at the Perry Street Theater. I don't think it was even a company. It was just the Perry Street Theater. Tony Giordano was directing. They were doing a little play with Michael Learned, who was in the Waltons. I'm sure you remember. And David Canary,
yes,
who
course.
Was a big soap star. And it was a play called Sally's Gone, She Left Her Name, about a family breaking up and a mother leaving. And there were two kids, a girl and a boy. And I auditioned for the boy and I got the role. So very soon after the Public, I was actually in a play and on stage in New York. Cynthia Nixon played my sister. She was 18 and I was 14.
And I think if we fade out, and we say years later, you ended up being her husband
exactly.
on the Gilded Age.
Well, that was a call that, that's how connections can help sometimes. That was
full circle. Wow.
Yeah. And that was a real joy because I've had to play a character who was in love with Cynthia Nixon. And I've basically been practicing doing that for about 40 years. So it was the easiest acting job of my life. But I did that play, and then I did others, and then I replaced Matthew in Brighton Beach Memoirs and Stephen Sondheim.
Well, wait, I'm not gonna let you jump that fast. Wait, I want to ask you a few questions.
Sure.
Yeah. No. I love it. I love it. I want to know, since you said earlier that you didn't like acting, what's happening? Why are you? Did you?
I'll
start
tell you
to
exactly
like
what's happening. I enjoyed the theater very, very much. I enjoyed being there. I enjoyed the camaraderie. I enjoyed the company feeling. And I enjoyed plays and I enjoyed musicals, watching them. I don't think I questioned very much when I was that age. I just kind of went where I was told. And it was exciting, you know. It was when you're 14 and you get approval, it's an exciting feeling because it's unfamiliar. So when I was told, they want you to do this play, and my mother said, "Oh my gosh, she's the mother on the Waltons," and it was all, I thought, fair enough. So I went to rehearsal. And I really believe, to a certain extent, that one of the greatest qualities an actor can have is some kind of, and I say this with a grain of salt, but indifference. There's nothing worse than an actor on stage with jazz hands, in the show Glee because I had that when I was in New Players. I was surrounded by kids just thrilled to show off and be on stage. And I think what made me stand out is I couldn't wait to get off it. And I think maybe Marty Winkler thought I was the next Brando, but really I was just kind of embarrassed to be there. It took years
so
until
when did
I
it be- change?
It's hard to say. Not Sally's Gone. That play was fun and I loved working with all of them, but I don't think that was a big journey acting wise for me. The next play I did was called The Beach House at Circle Rep. At the very last breaths of Circle Rep, I was in one of their last plays. Marshall Brickman, not Marshall Brickman, I'm sorry, Melvin Bernhardt directed.
Same initials.
Yeah. Swoosie Kurtz and George Grizzard and I were in a three-hander. And George was a godsend to me in so many ways. He taught me a great deal. And he taught me how to do it. And the more I learned to do it, the more fun I had doing it. And I think I'll tell you one thing I remember. I don't know when it fits into all this, but I went to see Kevin Kline in A Man for All, not A Man for All Seasons, the Shaw play.
Arms and the Man?
Arms and the Man. I want to say it was, or who played the girl. It wasn't Blythe, but Kevin played Blenchley, the soldier, the rebel soldier, who's put in the room with the conceited young girl all through act one. And I remember watching it, and I remember him, there's a moment she's being grand and ordering him around and using her grand voice and her very spoiled manner, and he laughs at her and she says, "How dare you? I've never met a man in my life. I've never met a man who hasn't taken me seriously." And he says, "I think you mean, don't you, that I'm the first man you've met who's taken you quite seriously."
Oh.
And I got it. By laughing at her and not going along with her pose, he was the first man who really was in a room with her and treated her like a human being and an equal. And I got it. I don't know if I was 16 or 17. I'd have to check the year, but I felt like I lifted off my seat a couple of inches. And that's, I mean, it has a lot to do with Kevin Kline, probably more to do with George Bernard Shaw, but that was one of the biggest moments for me. I don't know why, but I left this theater that night with a new excitement about what I did for a living.
That's interesting. It's almost like the clouds kind of separate and the sun comes through. It's an interesting thing. It happens in all our lives in different ways.
Yes.
But I want to know how Brighton Beach Memoirs, I mean, this is a big hit on Broadway. Matthew Broderick has scored in it. You're very young. I don't think you're more than 15 years old. And you go into this huge play. Did you have to audition for Neil and Gene Sachs?
No. The first time I met Gene Sachs was after one of the shows. I never met Neil. I was pretty late on. I think I went on, it ran for 3 years, and I went on fairly late in the run. No, by then it was the stage management, I think, and producers who were casting the replacements. I had seen it originally. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm sorry. Mark, write that down. I don't want to interrupt Bobby. Thank you. What I was going to say was, I work with Neil. I never had anyone I ever worked with were more hands-on than Neil Simon. So he must have approved you, but you didn't meet him.
That's true. You know what? And I'm misremembering it. He did come. I did see him at the play. And one night he came to see it, and I did speak with him briefly. I mean, there were a lot of Eugenes, you know. So I'm sure. Although in those days it wasn't on tape, I don't know how he would have seen me. I'm almost sure he wasn't at the audition. I could be misremembering it, but it was a heady experience, and it was a cushy Broadway beginning. I'd seen the original with Matthew. I had his autograph on a playbill that I'd gotten when I was 13 or whatever, whenever that was. Luckily for me, Dick Latessa, an actor named Dick Latessa, played the father, and he was extremely kind to me and helpful acting-wise. He once took me up. He came to my dressing room one night. For anyone who saw Matthew in that part, it was a phenomenal performance. It was comically very hard to step into those shoes. And so I did a lot of Matthew Broderick imitations, and which a lot of Eugenes did, I think, in that all three of those plays. But it was some line, you know, the mom says, "Eugene, what are you doing? I sent you to bed." And I say, "I've come down for water. You have water in your bathroom." And I say, "I can't drink that. There's toothpaste in the glass. It makes me nauseous." And it got a laugh. And I was saying it like Matthew Broderick. "It makes me nauseous," or something. And Dick Latessa came in my dressing room one night and said, I'll never forget it. He said, "Give me that line about the bathroom water glass. And I did, we ran through the five lines or so. And he said, I said, it makes me nauseous. And he said, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I said, how so? And he said, what's with that voice? What voice is that? It makes me nauseous. What is that voice? What are you doing? I said, I don't know. I didn't. He said, well, I don't buy it. He said, let's do it again, but don't do anything. Just talk to me. Do the scene as you. Talk to me. And I said, I can't drink from that glass. There's toothpaste in the glass. It makes me nauseous. And he said, do that tomorrow night. Trust me. Do that tomorrow night. You'll get an even bigger laugh. And I did. And I did. It was an incredibly good, very simple lesson for a young actor. But once you start doing something on stage that's not rooted in who you are, you've left the tracks.
Yeah, it's great that you have any kind of mentor, because in our business, sometimes people are terribly competitive. Mm-hmm. They go the other way. So it's nice that Dick Latessa did that for you.
Especially because that kid, that role was such a show-stopping role for any older actor. If they didn't have their ego intact, wouldn't have thought so highly of that young actor, I would imagine. But Dick was,
yes, that's
Dick,
right.
If anyone ever had their ego intact, it was Dick Latessa.
So let's see. You've replaced Matthew, and how does Peter Weir, the director, and you get together? I mean, after all, you're no more than 20 when you do that movie, but we'll talk about that right now, if you would. You and Peter Weir?
Well, it was during Brain Beach that I dropped out of high school, actually, because that was when I understudied for a while. I wasn't the understudy, but they hired me long before I actually had to step on a few weeks. So I served as the understudy and rehearsed at the same time. And I couldn't keep up with the work. I was on a bus from Ridgewood, New Jersey to the Port Authority every night and every day. I'd get home at midnight. I had to leave school early on Wednesdays, and my grades were suffering. And my parents and I made a choice, and I talked to the superintendent of schools and had a nice meeting with him. And he said, in my career as a superintendent, I've never advised this, but I think you're right. I think it makes sense that you should leave. And he said to me, get my GED and to bring him the scores. And I brought them the GED I took. And he said, take it easy. And I applied to Fordham, and I got into Fordham, and I moved to New York. I was 16. And I moved to 29th and 9th Avenue, a four-story walk-up, and I started at Fordham, and I started walking onto the stage at the then 46th Street Theater with Brighton Beach Memoirs. Anyway, so Brighton Beach led to Breaking the Code, another Broadway play with Derek Jacobi that I did. I'd have to look at my bio. I don't remember
one of the finest performances I've ever seen was Derek Jacobi in Breaking the Code. I still, it's embedded in what's left of my brain.
Yeah, mine too.
What a performance that was.
Yeah, that was an incredibly lucky, because I had seen him in play Cyrano. I don't know what year that would have been, 84 or so, with Sinead Cusack with the Royal Shakespeare. So I was extremely starstruck to work with him. I only had one scene. I was in the very beginning. I played the boy, his first crush in school, in a private school in Americanese. And I was in one scene in the beginning, and that was it. But I loved it. And I had done a couple of TV
and
movies.
Watch it.
I had done a couple of TV movies. I had done a couple of regular movies. I did a little tiny part in a movie called The Manhattan Project with John Lithgow that Marshall Brickman directed. I did a terrible movie called My Best Friend is a Vampire. I played the lead at that time when they were making all those teen movies of werewolves and vampires. So it was my shot at a teen comedy that failed, rightly. And then you bring up Dead Poets. That's a bit of a blank. I'm trying to remember how I got from... Well, I auditioned for a lot of things. I remember auditioning for Revolution with Al Pacino. You know, when you're a theater actor in New York, you go to auditions and there's really, you know, it was me, Christopher Colay, Cynthia Nixon, Sarah Jessica Parker. There were so few young actors on stage. It's just not a very high-paying gig and not something that most parents... I mean, if you went to audition for a commercial, there'd be hundreds of kids. But if you're auditioning for a play at Circle Rep, there weren't that many 14-year-olds trying to get a part at Circle Rep. So I started at a lucky time, unwittingly or unknowingly, certainly unintentionally. So by the time I got to...
By the way, did you ever get a commercial ever?
No, I auditioned for I don't know how many commercials. I never got one to this day, or a voiceover. I even tried those later. It's oil and water for some reason, but unlucky me financially.
Let's get back to Peter Weir and Dead Poets.
Okay, so hold on. I'm trying to remember. Dead Poet Society was just another audition for a movie that I knew I would never get. I went on a lot of them. I auditioned for, I don't know, Run. Patrick Dempsey got it. 12 O'Clock High. Casey Shemashko got it. I could list 30 more. Theater actors auditioned for movies back then, but not many. There weren't many of us around. They cast almost all of them from L.A. And they would send our tapes out, or occasionally directors would come to Howard Fuhrer's office, or Ellen Chenoweth's office, or whatever. But those movies didn't cast out.
Marion Dougherty.
Yes.
Marion Dougherty, Bonnie Timmerman.
Yeah, very much. I remember them all. Daniel Sweet did club and theater mostly. But so anyway, I auditioned and knew I'd never hear back about it. And then sure enough, and strangely enough, I did. And I went back in and read again. It was Howard Fuhrer's office. And I was auditioning for Todd, the stuttering, shy student that Ethan Hawke ended up playing. So my initial audition was for Todd, the other of the two boys. And I got pretty far auditioning for Todd and reading for Todd. And I don't know how many times I went in, maybe three. And then... I did a final audition with Peter Weir there, and pretty close to the audition, a few days before, maybe Howard called me and said, Peter wants you to read for Neil, the other part. And I said, what? I mean, it couldn't have been more, they couldn't be more different. These two kids. I so loved Todd, the stuttering and the shyness and the insecurity. And Neil was this Adonis who was sure of himself, and I pictured Redford or someone. And I said, oh, I think you're making a mistake. And I believe Howard said, Peter Weir doesn't make mistakes, which is true. Right. So I said, well, okay. And I looked at the sides and started learning the other lines. And I went in, and I met Ethan Hawke for the first time, because I walked in the room and there was the guy playing the role I wanted to play, at least in the audition. So Ethan read for Todd and I read for Neil. We were both off book. We did the scene a few times. And then next thing I knew, Howard said, it looks like it's going forward. They want to do a screen test. I don't even know if they do those anymore. And I went in and did an old-fashioned Montgomery Clift screen test. And then I got the part.
I guess
no one more shocked than I.
Well, that movie, I'm sure, changed your career and the success of it and how good you were and how good actually the movie was. Let's talk about the star, because you couldn't really get a nicer man than Robin Williams. I hope he was that way with you.
Robin was very kind with us. I never knew him well. The one thing I always remember and look back at with interest was, now that I have played Atticus Finch in a play, a stage version of Mockingbird, and I played Harold Hill. I now, as an older man, I know what it's like to be what my friend Craig Bierko calls being the guy. When you're the guy, the guy can be a girl too, if it's Gypsy or whatever. But if you're the one, if you're number one on the call sheet, on the movie set, in a theater, there's no equivalent of that. But if you're the person, if you're Atticus, and you're in a play with young people, that's a very strange place to be and a wonderful place to be, but very interesting and unique. When you're Harold Hill and there are 12 children in your cast, or when you're Atticus and there are 9, because when I did it in London, and each of the kids in Mockingbird were triple cast. So I had 3 Gems and 3 Scouts and 3 Dills. You know, it puts you in a very interesting position. It's a very enviable one, and I adored being in it. They look up to you so much, as we did with Robin. And I felt at least a fierce like a mother cub or something. I mean, fiercely protective of them, interested in them, in helping them. And I did not get that sense from Robin. But now that I look back on it and know what I know about him and his life, it makes sense. It always seems strange to me that I don't think I ever saw him off the set of the movie. Even I did a movie called Mr. and Mrs. Bridge with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and Paul Newman as laid back and not reticent, but he was not the most outgoing guy. Even then, you know, the kids in that movie, Kira Sedgwick and I and this woman, Maggie Welsh, played his children. We went to dinner at Paul and Joanne's house at least a dozen times in the place they were staying while we shot the movie. It's just kind of what you do. And Robin, no. And especially in that role, I found that amazing. And at the time, I wondered if maybe he was doing it on purpose to keep a kind of distance from us, to keep a mystery that should be there between a student and a teacher. And perhaps he did. But I'm more inclined now to believe, looking at his life and what he was struggling with, which I wasn't aware of, I think he was just a more complicated guy than I thought he was. And he had demons I didn't know about, or blue devils, as Tennessee Williams calls them.
Yeah.
You know,
I spoke with Robin, and I was amazed when he told me that all the years he did Mork and Mindy, how he found out the show was canceled was in Variety.
What?
Can you imagine? Yeah. And the anger that he had years later, this was years later, still about nobody from the network, the production company, told him it was canceled. He read it in Variety. Now that can mess your head up just enough, you know?
I mean, that's astonishing. He could not have been a bigger star in that role. I find that so confusing, but who knows? I wonder why that happened.
You went from that movie to Mr. and Mrs. Bridge. That was the very next movie.
Yes.
I think.
The first thing I did is I did Romeo and Juliet in New York, a production of Romeo and Juliet.
For a movie to next movie. Yeah.
I believe that was my next film. Yes.
Yeah, I think so. And knowing a little bit Paul and Joanne as I did, I guarantee you were going over the house because of Joanne.
Yeah. Well, Joanne always said, I asked her about Paul once, and she said, look around the table at everybody when we're all together later. You'll see that wherever everyone's face is, Paul's face is 2 inches behind that. She said, if everyone's sitting around a table, he'll be 2 inches further back. She said, that's Paul.
Yeah.
I loved him. I had a great time with him. I didn't have a problem in the world with him. He was complicated, and he was not warm and cuddly, but I adored him.
Tell me, what do you want from a director? What are you looking for in a play or in film? But since I know theater is your real love, we'll start with theater. What are you looking for from a director in theater?
So many things. Knowing when the idea in the room that is best is best, even when it's not yours, is essential. A lot of times there'll be an idea of how to do something or how to make something work, and it'll come from the most unlikely places, including an actor. And the best directors don't hesitate, and they snatch it. Peter Weir was perfect, an example of that one. Ethan Hawke and I once rewrote an entire scene in the middle of the night while shooting it, because we felt the scene didn't work, and it reminded me of that time when Mel Brooks talks about Gene Wilder convincing him to let the monster dance and sing Puttin' on the Ritz and Young Frankenstein, and he thought it was silly and ridiculous and not right for the film at all, and Gene fought to put it in the movie, and Mel then admitted later it was the best thing in the film. Peter was like that. So that humility essentially is what that is, artistic humility. I remember, I mean, a play is, there are many aspects to play. Casting is one of them, but I did a play called The Invention of Love by Tom Stoppard, which was, almost incomprehensible when I read it. It's about A.E. Housman, the classicist and poet during World War I in England. Pretty heady stuff, heady in Tom Stoppard's way, not the magic mushroom way. And not easy, pretty dense stuff. And when I met with Jack O'Brien, the director, I said, all this stuff, I don't understand this reference and that reference. I don't understand this. And he said, that's why I'm getting Bob Crowley. And Bob Crowley designed our sets.
Yeah.
And Bob Crowley is the eye candy king of New York City when it comes to theater. And it's probably the best thing, Jack, the most important decision Jack made in that production, because it was one of the most beautiful. I never saw it, of course, but I've seen pictures. There was a reflective black floor. There was a scene where the boys are rowing on the river, and they had Bob built boats that had silent casters on them so the boats could float around the stage. And Jack knew. If you've ever seen the production of Hairspray that he directed, you'd know what I mean. He knows when to whore it up, as he would say. I love people who know how to sell a play and make it exciting to watch, because sometimes it's not the easiest road from what's on the page to making an audience lift out of their seats a little bit. So I look for someone who does all that.
I understand. I have to say, as an audience member, having seen both Arcadia and Invention of Love, and thinking I'm reasonably intelligent, I could not tell you what the hell I was watching most of the time. I was grateful for the real thing. At least I understood.
That's a little more accessible than most of his others.
I need accessible with Stoppard, I'm afraid. Except I did love Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, or whatever, dead, alive, whatever they are.
Dead, yes.
But yeah, I did like that very much. But you've really seemed to have taken on, I think unwittingly, some of the hardest plays ever written in English. I mean, when you think about it, go back and think, what, Long Day's Journey into Night, Philadelphia, Here I Come, Arcadia, Invention of Love. These are big, exciting plays, but I don't know, as an actor, they must be real tough. Let's take one at a time. Let's start with the cast of all casts. I mean, Brian Dennehy, Vanessa Redgrave, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Robert Sean Leonard. What a cast. I mean, holy cow. And what performances. There's a play I understood, and I had no doubt. Must have been a very interesting and perhaps grueling experience.
You've nailed it on the head. It was interesting and grueling. I was relieved when it was over. It was very hard. very hard work. It's my favorite. You know, I can't say it's my favorite play, but it is. It's one of the two of them, of my favorite plays. I think it's, I love Iceman Cometh and I love Moon for the Misbegotten and so much of what he wrote, but I believe Long Days is untouchable to me as far as it's just, it's like, I once saw, Tony, Kushner once compared Eugene O'Neill to the way whales feed in the ocean. He said some feed closer to the surface, and then there are the great blue whales and the larger whales who sound miles below and eat miles below the surface. And he said, and that was O'Neill. We're all in the water where you can still see the glimmers of the sun. And O'Neill sounded and went deeper than anyone ever, even Shakespeare, I believe he said, emotionally far deeper than anyone's gone. Those are strong words, but I don't find any fault in them. It was a great honor to do that play. As Phil and I once said, having a cigarette sitting in front of the theater one night while the sun was setting between the buildings on wherever we were, 45th Street, I think. It was about 7 o'clock. We were about to go in, and he said, you know, every now and then something hits me, and I just realized we are in doing possibly the best American play ever written, in possibly the most impressive place you can do it, in undoubtedly with the greatest cast we could do it with. And he said, don't forget that. We did this. So you're right. It was an incredibly important, interesting, exhausting an experience for me, and one I'll never forget, and I wouldn't trade for anything in the world.
No. Tell me about Philip Seymour Hoffman, because he's died so tragically young and was such a major talent, and one actor that really believed in theater. You know, a lot of them talk it, but they don't walk it. He did both.
Yes, and also he was an artist. I don't consider myself an artist. I love acting, and I love being a part of a company, and I love figuring out a role, and I love figuring out the best way to phrase a line or time an entrance. It's a fun craft. I can't imagine a more enjoyable craft to practice. But to me, an artist is O'Neill or Hemingway or Mozart. I believe artists create, and I believe what I do is I interpret. So I don't mean, maybe this is an artist with a lowercase a, I don't know. Because surely violin players are artists, but I wouldn't say they're the same kind of artist that Mozart is. One is a genius and one is an interpretive soul who takes something written and interprets it beautifully in some cases. And I think that's what I do. Ethan Hawke is another one I think is closer on the spectrum to the Mozarts. I never drifted that way. I love what I do, but I very much like Dennehy. We both, I think, saw eye to eye on that. Dennehy and I were one end of the boat, and Phil and Vanessa were quite far on the other side of the boat in that aspect of it. They were very, Dennehy and I are very Spencer Tracy based. We want to know where to sit and where to enter. And Phil and Vanessa are much.
Not buck into the furniture.
Right. Nice to know where the furniture is. Vanessa would enter different entrances sometimes just because she felt like it. Phil, I would like to say he acted Jamie Tyrone 8 times a week, but I don't think he did. I think he was Jamie Tyrone 8 times a week. I acted Edmund. I acted it well, but Phil was different. He was a different animal, and I'm sure that's part of the reason why his life was what it was, and the pain he felt was probably nothing I am familiar with. I don't know Phil very well. I never did. He wasn't a friend of mine, but he once referred to me in a book I read. He did a book of interviews, and he once referred to me as the actor who listened the best on stage. As of all the actors he'd worked with, he felt I listened better than anyone. And he said, and believe me, as a loudmouth, I can tell you that's a lot harder than listening's a lot harder than talking on stage. Yeah. So that was very nice of him, and it meant a lot to me. And I think I know what he means, what he meant. I could go on and on. It was an incredible experience. Phil was complicated, but very, very good. We were all very good in different ways, I thought. Vanessa was nuts, and very much not Mary Tyrone in my mind when they cast her. I've always seen Mary Tyrone as kind of a very wallflower, nervous, pretty little Catholic girl who married the movie, the theater star. And Vanessa scares the hell out of me. I mean, I did not see her as the Mary Tyrone that I'd had in my head, but she took it from my head and wrestled it out.
I produced a play with her called Vitor and Virginia with Eileen Atkins. And she would come on, I would say, a few times a week, because I would go. The director was Zoe Caldwell. Mm-hmm. So it was quite, I used to say, I'm going to rehearsal with my three tall women.
Yeah, three pretty intimidating women as well.
And fortunately, I wasn't intimidated, but I was rather surprised at how Vanessa often would change what she had done, let's say the night before.
Oh, well, I'll
and
tell you.
The most amazing, I'll tell you quickly, because she's a sensational actress. I mean, no one can take that away from her. But I went one night, and it's only a two-hander, Vitor and Virginia. Mm-hmm. And one night, I see her looking upstage and snapping her fingers. I have no idea. That's not in the play. Was never done in the play. And I went backstage, and I said to Eileen, what's going on with Vanessa turning upstage and snapping her fingers? She said, that's been going on since Tuesday. She's snapping her fingers for the dogs.
Yep.
There's no dogs in the play.
Yeah, well, there is now.
Okay. That Thursday.
Yeah. The night Austin Pendleton saw Long Day's Journey Tonight, I will never forget, for the very reason that Vanessa, there's a moment in the play, speaking of Eugene O'Neill diving deep, when Edmund says to his mother has a morphine addiction, and she sends the maid to town to get her morphine. And the son says, Mama, you can't send Kathleen to get your medicine. And Mary says, why? And Edmund says, everyone will know. And she says, know what? And there's a horrible pause. And she says, that I have rheumatism in my hands, that I suffer from rheumatism in my hands. And then she pauses and says, I didn't know what rheumatism was until you were born. It's one of the most horrible things in the play, because it's clear she means her addiction. And she's saying, the reason I became an addict was when you were born.
It's you.
You caused
it. Because of you.
Yeah. It's what she's saying. The mother to her son. So
yes.
One night, Vanessa said, across that vast stage, and she always had a way of saying rheumatism that was unmistakable as the addiction. She would say, that I suffer from rheumatism and pain in my hands. And she would say, I didn't know what rheumatism was until you were born. And then she would say, we move on. One night she didn't say that. She said, suffer from rheumatism in my hands. And I was waiting for the great line of, I didn't know. She didn't say it. And then she put her hands up like this, like a witch, silently, just like this. And the oxygen left the theater. And she slowly walked over to me, a whole length of the stage, with her hands like this. And as she got closer, she started making a kind of a witchy sound. She went like, until she got right in front of me. And then she threw her hands down and said, I didn't know what rheumatism was until you were born. And then she whacked me so hard, she spun me into the set. And I actually collided with the flat. She apologized later. But, you know, in that play, then in Act Four, Mary's upstairs almost the entirety of the act. The boys are playing poker downstairs with the one light bulb. And you hear her walking. And James keeps saying, shh, shh, because he doesn't want her to come down. And Austin said, let me tell you something. After that slap, he said, that fourth act, I've never felt anything like that. It was terror. Every time we'd hear a creak, the audience was terrified. That moment did something to that play, this performance anyway, that gave Mary a dimension I've never seen in that play. And she apologized afterward, and I said, it's fine. It hurt, and it was surprising, but it was fine. And then, being Vanessa, of course, she didn't do it the next night, but then did do it the night after. And she started to do it sporadically without telling you, which was, of course, like worse than anything. But it kept me on my toes, you know.
I was going to say, if she was the director, you would say, well, she wants to keep me fresh and scared.
Phil Hoffman said it best. He laughed and looked down and said, you know what? It's a great idea. And I thought, it is a great idea, actually.
Yeah, it was a terrific idea. I don't think the dogs in Vita in Virginia were a great idea. But okay, I'll take one out of two is not bad.
Yeah, with Vanessa, you got to take it all or nothing.
Yeah, but boy, when she's good, she is very, very good.
And
I
thought Brian was also every bit as good in that play. That's a very hard part. It's a much less showy part than, I mean, there's that great speech about Shakespeare in Act Four, but I thought Brian was heartbreaking. He was heartbreakingly simple. He seemed to be such a simple man. He once said it in rehearsal. Phil was going on and on about something, and something heady and complicated and motivation oriented, and Brian was like, and Phil said, Brian, Jesus, Brian, you're looking at me like I'm sorry. You're looking at me like I'm some kind of crazy. And Phil said, Brian said, Phil, no, he said kid. He always said kid. He said, kid, every time you open your mouth, I feel like I'm a mailman who walked into the wrong room.
To say, Bobby, in you know, when you think of a classical actor, Shakespearean actor, that's kind of strange casting, Brian Dennehy.
I agree.
I can't take away his really fine. I mean, he was a wonderful actor. I really liked him, but I didn't see him as the father. I didn't.
That's
see
fine.
Him. You know, I saw him more as the truck driver.
I think because Brian's a similar actor, a similar animal to what I am as an actor, I've never thought of James O'Neill as Brian Dennehy. But when I saw him do it, I thought, well, that's fascinating to see James Tyrone as a pretty simple guy and not an artist at all, but just a guy who got lucky, who was good looking in his 20s and got lucky on stage and found something in Shakespeare that was undefinable, but worked for him and made Edwin Booth love his work. But I agree that it's not all the elements of that part are not in Brian Dennehy or were not, but I love the elements that were.
Well, I like the idea of you describing half the boat with you and Brian and Vanessa and Phil.
Oh, you don't know the half of it.
I think that's a good analogy. Tell me a little bit about Philadelphia, Here I Come, another tough play, Brian Friel, and I think you're with Milo O'Shea at that time.
Yeah, Milo played Pop. Jim True, Chicago boy, played Public. It's a play in which the lead role, the boy who's desperate to leave Ireland behind, is played by two actors. One actor plays his public self, and one plays his private thoughts. It's a trick. I thought Brian Friel pulled it off brilliantly. I'm not sure. You have to be a pretty good writer to do that. It's a pretty showy trick theatrically, but I'm sure I was okay. I don't think I was nearly as good enough actor, let alone grammarian. I think that part is very, very hard. And I did the best I could. And you have to be young because he's a young soul. Like, it'd be interesting to see it played with an older person as his private self. But my memories of that are frustrating because I felt I was okay in it, and I wanted to be great in it. But I love the play. I love Brian Friel. He's one of my favorite playwrights, and it's a charming play. It's a young play compared to his others. It's a little clunky, I think, but it's heartbreakingly simple, as most young plays are, like Menagerie. There are lots of flaws in it, but its youth and its naivete are something you can't fake later, no matter how brilliant you are. So things like In Glass Menagerie, I think, and Philadelphia, Here I Come, to me are equally as important and beautiful and powerful as incredibly beautifully crafted plays as I guess Arcadia, or Stoppard's later plays, or Chaw's.
It is interesting. Glass Menagerie, Philadelphia, Here I Come, Long J.H. Journey, all very autobiographical by the writer. Now, we all know writers take what they know in their history, but those three plays that we've just talked about are probably... Well, we didn't talk about, we named Glass Menagerie, but they are really each of those writers, many ways, finest work in some ways to me.
Yeah. Well, so, it's the adage of write what you know.
And
the fact that
they knew it.
Longley's Journey was what O'Neill knew is horrifying, but it is true. As he says in the dedication in the very first page of that play, he dedicates it to Carlotta. That it was a play written in blood. And it was, Carlotta used to say he'd come out of the room from working on that play and look like a ghost, like he wasn't there.
Yes. It really, some writers have such pain when they write. It's interesting. Thank you so much, Bobby, for doing this, interview. It meant a lot to me.
It's you're just you calling me the other day meant a lot to me. The paths crossing in this field that we are in is very important and meaningful. And it's lovely to see you and lovely to hear your voice again. And fun to visit all these places you've taken me to. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.